Welcome to ADHD Gathering. I'm your host, Ying Ding, also known as ADHD Asian Girl. I'm an award-winning ADHD coach, certified meditation teacher, and featured expert in Self Magazine. Your ADHD brain is not a problem to fix, it's an ecosystem to understand. Let's explore it together. Today's podcast is a start of a new mini-series. The seed that started this for me is really want to ask this question of how do we face this moment? And I think what better way to do it than dialoguing with some of my friends and great teachers I get to know. So today I have Ash with me, and Ash and I met at Cloud Sangha when we were working together, and now we have become good friends. Ash Lounsbury is an eco-psychologist and enrolled citizen of the Osage Nation. Ash holds a non-clinical master's in eco-psychology from Naropa Level 1 and 2 certificates in ecotherapy from the Earth Body Institute. Her graduate research culminated in a dissertation on the intersection of ancient bird divination and contemporary ecotherapeutic modalities. Ash sometimes writes about myth, eco-queerness, and birds. With over a decade of meditation experience, she's had the honor to support Tara Brock and Jack Kornfield's virtual meditation community members. In 2025, she co-founded Earth Wild Ecology Club, where she co-facilitates virtual eco-psychological workshops. So welcome to my podcast, Ash. It's so good to have you.
Thank you so much, Ying. It feels like such an honor to be here. When you first told me that you were going to be embarking on this journey of asking your friends and mentors, how are we facing this moment? That felt like such a supportive question, and I was really curious myself. So I'm excited to see how all of the knowledge and wisdom that you accumulate in this voyage.
Thank you. I'm really excited for all that may come from this container. So my first question is, how are you experiencing this moment? What are you perceiving?
Yeah, I'm going to start with present moment right now. The sun is shining. It feels like spring is really on its way. We were encased in snow the past week, and I'm feeling a lot of relief that the earth is warming up and bugs are coming out and birds are singing. And also holding that with awareness of the poly crises that's engulfing our world. It feels like it's a global level politically and climate. And then also at these micro levels of the community, my own community, and knowing that a lot of people's local communities are also undergoing this struggle.
I'm hearing a lot of, yes, the spring is coming and there are so many crises. We're recording on February 13th, 2026, and it's the first day that Saturn moved into Aries. We had some historical snowstorm on the east coast of the United States. And I'm noticing in the morning, there are more birds singing now. I'm listening to it and get excited. I'm like, oh, spring is coming. My question then is, how do your identities of neurodivergence or culture background shape your experience and response of this moment?
I have this privilege of navigating the world as a cisgendered, white, able-bodied human that gives me more financial fluidity and stability in navigating the world. I don't have the same experience as somebody who has a different body. So I just want to speak that I'm coming from like this privileged place. I am able to face the challenges of the world with this eco-psychological understanding because I had the privilege of time and access to higher education that allowed me to deepen my understanding of, re-remember my connection to the earth, which is also a privilege because a lot of people, the intersection of nature and humanity can be a point of danger when you have to weather storms and you don't have access to shelter. So that's how I'm facing the moment in that way. And also, thanks for bringing up neurodivergence. I've been thinking a lot about autistic joy. I still don't have a definition for what that means necessarily. I can't pull an academic definition out of my head about that, but there's something about leaning into my own autistic joy of feeling embodied, like speaking to the sun and really feeling the warmth of that. And I also want to name that entering into this conversation with you, I was thinking about the intersection of neurodivergence and social and environmental justice. And whenever I enter into social justice spaces, it's anecdotal. So I might be totally off base, But it seems like there's this overlap between neurodivergent folks and folks who are really into social justice. For me, it feels like it's almost like rule-based. I'm like, oh, we should all be following these core rules as humans, minimizing suffering and harm. And then I'm seeing systems that are not following those rules. And there's something in me that wants to shift the system to follow these rules that I value. And I'm saying rules in this shared language. I don't think that word is necessarily what I'm totally meaning, but yeah.
Yeah, I'm also cisgender, able body, have my own flavor of neurodivergence. And I'm really curious about two things here. One is when you said you're experiencing this world from that eco-psychology lens, I'm curious about what is eco-psychology and how has deepened the practice or understanding that field or re-remembering our connection to nature. How has that changed you or helped you to meet this moment?
Yeah. So first I'll start with what is eco-psychology? And it's the study of human relationship with nature. That's how it's conceptualized. And I just want to name that humans are nature. So I think it's like there's this relation with self, right? We're all part of this interconnected earth body. I was able to pursue a graduate degree. I had the privilege of having an ecotherapist as a counselor for a few years during the pandemic. And now I have another therapist who's also an ecotherapist. So I've this sense I was able to drop into this healing space of being with nature. What I studied at Naropa was like these recollections of childhood memories of being in nature or what our ecological identity is, which goes back to generational examination. One of our tasks was to interview one of our living ancestors and what their relationship with nature was. And how does that inform your own? How does that trickle down? Which I think is fascinating.
Your work is oriented towards this field. I'm curious about how does it show up in your general daily life?
It feels constant to me. Once I've opened this, it's like I have this lens that I'm seeing the world through and I can't shutter that lens. It feels like a really beautiful way to view the world. There's something about animism in that too. The earth is this living thing. There's a scholar, James Lovelock, who talks about the earth itself, like the planet. You could imagine it almost like a redwood tree, where if you dissect the redwood tree and see the rings, you can see almost the earth being replicated. You have the heartwood. It's more of like an inert matter, like the core of the earth. And then it becomes more lively as you get closer to the outer rings of the bark. So you can imagine the earth like that. And we're just like inhabitants on this redwood earth. And the trees obviously are alive. But thinking of the planet itself as like this living being is really exciting for me. Thinking about that, I get a lot of sense of belonging from that. I have practices in place because sometimes I dissociate or compartmentalize or forget. Like I'll get into a trance of doom scrolling. I just become this pair of eyeballs instead of an actual human. Watching the sunrise has been one of my favorite eco-psychological practices, of watching this transformation from darkness to light. And it goes back to how winter is coming into spring slowly.
I wish I'm a morning person to be able to watch the sunrise. That leads me into the next question of what are some practices that are sustaining you, whether it's eco-psychology lens or meditation lens?
I feel like I've had this fortune the past year or so to accumulate a lot of practices that are sustaining me. One I want to name is being in community feels really sustaining. Virtual Sangha spaces. Yeah, that feels like such a rich container where I can set down this heavy load and feel witnessed by other humans. Talking to friends, like talking to you about the different landscapes that we're each navigating and how there's differences in our experience. And then there's also this underlying similarity. Sometimes I feel hopelessness comes over me when I reach out and talk to friends. It seems to mitigate that, but we're in this together, tapping into the collective and hanging out in nature, where that is the collective space. And that can look small, like witnessing the sunrise, like I'm inside and I just open my window, just the blinds, and then watch the sunrise. It doesn't have to be like an extravagant hike or anything. Usually I just find these really small practices, like when I'm out walking the dogs, just taking time to witness the birds. who are there.
We will be right back. First, if today's episode is resonating with you, I'm available for one-on-one coaching for ADHD adults who are ready to stop forcing and start building a life that actually flows with their brain. My approach is mindful, strategic, and multidimensional because you're more than a to-do list. If you're curious, there's a link in the show notes to book a free discovery call. I would love to connect.
I love that, the small practices and then being with friends and tapping to the collective, whether it's human collective or nature collective. And I love the idea of Earth as a living being. Yeah. Sometimes I forget that and it's magical for me and to re-remember. Oh yeah, that's right. Earth is this living thing and we're little dots in the space spinning. I think that's what nature and as well as like astrology or astronomy opens for me is to help me to zoom way out and re-remember. That's the scale. I'm curious about what are your current practices of bird divination? First, what is bird divination?
Yeah, bird divination. That's actually one of the ways I've been filling my cup and also offering to others is I offer these community bird divination workshops in person and virtually. I had this professor, Dr. Tina Fields at Naropa, and she provided this practice where we used nature as oracle. And in her practice, she had us go find large rocks. We were all tasked to bring these large rocks with us to Colorado. We were coming from all over the country. And then we had a witness, one person we partnered with, and we took turns rock scrying, looking at the fissures and markings of the rock to answer our deep sacred questions. In the lecture leading up to that, she mentioned bird divination. I've always loved watching birds, relating to birds, and getting this deep sense of belonging from birds, noticing that whenever I was out in nature, the birds would be watching me and I'd watch them. I've had one of my first spiritual experiences in nature with a hawk who soared by at eye level right behind me and was looking at me. Just having this really deep connection. When she mentioned bird divination, I was like, what is that? Immediately, my research cap was put on. I was able to research bird divination as an ecotherapeutic modality for my graduate dissertation. That started this train. I offered that practice to my ecopsych cohort. They really loved the practice. And I started offering it to the community in Asheville shortly after we had Hurricane Helene come through. And a lot of people were facing this climate anxiety and ecological grief. Since then, I've been offering these workshops seasonally. It's similar to the rock scrying that I named. You come to it with a sacred question, and I'll guide people into these inquiries or invite them to create their own, like a tarot deck. We meet in a park. I invite people to go out and wander the land and witness the birds for 10 minutes, and then we come back and share our experiences. And it can take on different themes. Right now, the theme can come in with the inquiries, how can you sustain a wave of change? And that's the inquiry I've been bringing to the birds currently. When I'm out walking the dogs, I'm like, okay, I'm going to hold this question in my heart and just see who shows up and what shows up. It's this practice of meaning making, which I think is really important for humans to engage in, is to assign meaning to things and get meaning out of things that we're interacting with every day. There's also studies that birdsong signal safety to our bodies. So it's physiologically really grounding for humans in that way too. And I think there's also magic in practicing in the collective. So when we're in a group and sharing our insights, it has that spark of, oh, your insight has reminded me of some fire that's within me. And I think that's really magical.
Yeah. Wow. I didn't quite realize you were bridging the ancient practice of bird divination with the ecotherapeutic modality. That's beautiful. And I love the idea of having an inquiry that's hanging out with you for a while. I love this question of how do we sustain a wave of change? That's very much on my mind too. How would you define Sangha? Sangha is a practice group?
Yeah, a practice group. And I think like one of the important things for me in Sangha, it's usually the same people that show up or it's like a regular occurrence of people so you can deepen that relationship.
And I love that in a group when people remind each other of wisdoms and insights and fire within each other. Yeah, that's definitely something really unique about practicing a group. That lends well to the next question of what engaged practice or value-driven action look like for you right now? What feels possible and what feels necessary?
Yeah, that does lend itself to collective spaces. Right now, I've had this honor to volunteer with the Work That Reconnects Network, which is Joanna Macy's network. Joanna Macy, she recently passed, but she is a deep ecologist and Buddhist scholar, and her teachings like center active hope. The Work That Reconnects Network has done so much work in spreading these practices of generating hope and collective wisdom. I've been able to help support that in small ways. I think a lot about service as one of my core values. When I think about how can I give back to the community or how can I be of service, it sometimes feels overwhelming. I think a nature connection practice has to be huge. Sometimes I think these acts of service need to be huge to be meaningful. I've been leaning into small is also good and beneficial. So I'll help support in the ways that I can within my own capacity. You also named what feels possible and what feels necessary. Something about being in these collective spaces, I'm noticing that humans are more likely to engage with their fears. I was reading the Sustainability Journal about climate action and how collective action needs to happen for climate action to be successful. It can't just be done on this individual level. And there's this component of trust that needs to occur for collective action to also be successful. I'm thinking collective action being necessary, but complicated because we live in this individualized society where we're interacting with our screens most of the time. I talked to my daughter about this earlier this week. We were walking around a lake, and my daughter and I like to explore these dark avenues of, oh, what's going to happen when the world crumbles? She'll go off and on what her apocalyptic ideas are, and I'll share mine because it seems inevitable, right? There's something crumbling in our world currently. So it's this imagination game that we're playing. We started talking about what food sources would look like. And then I asked her, but we've been in a natural disaster crisis before, and we were not in a place that was devastated as much as other places in Asheville. And we were able to witness the community coming together. And it wasn't this apocalyptic vision. I think of Rebecca Solnit's work. She touches a lot on this, whereas it's really easy for us to have these nightmare visions of what humanity would look like as systems crumble. But really, I think there is this desire to trust one another and to form these collective networks. My daughter reflected that back. She was like, yeah, we were just taking care of each other after Helene.
To have the tangible experience of that, it's so important. I've been doom scrolling this week. I think the question I'm wrestling with is similar to what you were saying in terms of facing climate change. We need both individual action and collective action. I was wrestling with their individual good that's happening, but what if cumulatively an aggregate level of individual good does not outweigh structural suffering? If that's the case, I still think the individual good has meaning. I don't know if it's the Asianness in me or wanting certainty as a human. I almost want to hold on to, oh, love is bigger than fear. But I think I'm at this point of seeing the world clearly that there are a lot of structural sufferings. And I just realized for me, the individual good still has meaning. And the most honest answer I have for myself is that not resist. That's not a viable alternative to me.
Yeah, I know that sometimes I feel, oh, what good is it of me? I can't change the world. And then there's also part, I do have this narrative of like caretaker and, oh, it's up to me. And somehow the reason the world is the way it's my fault. I oscillate between those two things wildly. And I think it's easy to lose sight of how there is power in our individual actions, even if we're serving as role models for other people. And then it becomes this ripple effect and it's beyond our individual existence.
And it leads to the next question of what have you seen in your community of examples of resistance and sources of hope? Or what are some role models? I would say seeing other people's light and fire sometimes ignites something in me. I'm curious about what are you seeing?
In the Asheville community, we've had solidarity protests against ICE and what's happening in Minneapolis currently. My daughter's high school hosted a walkout a couple of weeks ago in solidarity with Minneapolis, and the kids that organized it received in-school suspension. It's like these beautiful actions are occurring and then the system just shuts them down. I've been feeling hopeful and seeing others not get so discouraged. For me, that feels discouraging to just be shut down so quickly. But it seems like people are continuing to rally, which I think is really heartening. There's also a lot of local concerns in the Asheville community. The university for the past year has been planning on developing this urban forest that's part of university property. It's 45 acres of forest that students have used in the environmental sciences department as an experimental field. Neighbors use it as a trail, and there's more than human beings that live there. The university wants to develop it, and there's artists and poets and community members buying billboards and having different displays of resistance against this. And somehow they want to develop it to make more money for the university in ways that don't seem very clear avenues of profit. Not that profit should be the point anyway. And there's been protests resisting plans to build data centers in town. We have this small town right outside of Asheville called Canton. There's only 4,000 people that I think live there, but hundreds of people came out to resist the building of this data center. And also people are tearing down flock cameras. They're these symbols of the ultimate digital surveillance state. They're high-powered cameras. They're all around town in Asheville, and they can read license plates and do facial recognition, and they feed into this data center. That's not great, but people in Asheville are tearing them down, which feels good, like civil disobedience, I guess. There's also these coming together spaces, people tending to community gardens and operating free pantries and free fridges and giving out free period products. It seems like the community is geared towards trying to fill these gaps that are left in the wake of local leaders and policymakers.
After disasters, the usual imagination is, oh my God, human beings going to turn on each other. It's usually actually the opposite. Human beings are really oriented towards helping each other. And so many inspiring actions from your community. And yes, data centers. I live in a county in Northern Virginia. There's so many data centers. It's like the highest concentration, probably. I was researching about it yesterday. Just grateful there are people out there who are tracking where they are on the map, which ones are built, which ones are in progress, what bills are being proposed at the state level to regulate data centers. I'm leaning into either having some wishing of the world that you can offer or some micro practice you can maybe lead us through, whatever feels the most appropriate to you and the most alive in you.
Thank you for that offering. I think I'll offer a practice. I'm imagining this as a sphere of influence practice, thinking back about the waves of change that we can commit to. I want to name, as I was focusing on this practice, I wrote down the word individual actually means to be indivisible. It can be really easy to construe the word individual as something that means isolated or alone, but it's actually like the particles of an atom. I've been thinking about individuals being indivisible and how collectiveness can also be indivisible in a way. Here goes the practice. I invite you to close your eyes if that feels comfortable for you. Slowly bring your attention to your body. Again, anything that I'm naming is this invitation. If it doesn't feel comfortable or accessible, you can let my voice wash over you. So I'm going to invite us to notice our own sphere of influence. And I'm thinking of this as where our physical boundaries exist. So if you want, you can notice where your skin touches the air. Or you could bring your attention to where your body is meeting whatever solid foundation you're on. So if you're sitting, you can focus on where your body is touching your seat, or if you're standing, you can bring your attention to where your feet are touching the ground. Then you can bring your attention up to your legs. Your abdomen. Just imagining the space that your body is taking up. Your hands, your arms. Your chest. Your head. Maybe bringing your attention to the very crown of your head. And then bring your attention to your face. And think of your face as like this boundary in relation to others. Like, how close do you need to be to somebody else to communicate with your body? Like waving or gesticulating wildly. And then how close do you need to be to communicate with somebody with like just your facial expressions, like smiling? And now I invite you to imagine the proximity that your voice has. How far away can you be from somebody to communicate with your voice? Like, what can you convey through shouting? Or then imagine the closeness needed to communicate through calm words. Like, how much more nuanced can you get when you're closer to somebody? And now bringing this to the collective. As you're listening, we're entering into a collective space of being. And you can imagine these proximities expanding, like two voices shouting would be louder than just one voice, so you'd be able to expand that communication. And if you can imagine the collective as being multiple people listening, or participating in this practice, what we could communicate with our bodies. I'm thinking in Minneapolis, a bunch of bodies stood together and spelled out SOS on a frozen lake. And how far away that could be seen from an aerial view. And then you can try to imagine what happens if we lose one voice. Like somebody decides, oh, it's not for me, this action isn't for me. What happens to that collective field? What happens to the SOS shape on the lake? Or what happens when there's two people yelling and one person stops? Now imagine losing two voices. Then, if you want to bring your attention back to your body, if that feels comfortable. And I just want to invite the inquiry that I brought up earlier that you can sit with and bring with you through the day or the week. And it's how can I sustain my wave of change? How can I sustain my wave of change? And you can enter this inquiry knowing maybe a little bit more about your own sphere of influence and knowing the power of the collective and feeling into your own contribution. And then when you're ready, you can open your eyes if they're closed or come back to regular space.
Thank you for leading us through that. Thank you so much, Ash, for being on my podcast. And are there any final words or anything we want to share, or where can we find you? Anything like that?
Yeah, I do want to name that I have this quote from Joanna Macy that I scribbled down on my little practice sheet, and it ties into our conversation. So I'm just gonna read that quote really quick. She's talking about systems theory. The more of a system or collective, she writes, is lost from view when a system's composite units are investigated independently. So I'm thinking of how, like, when we microscopically look at what we're doing individually, we lose sight of how we're contributing.
That's a beautiful quote. Which book is it from?
It's from Mutual Causality in Buddhism and General Systems Theory.
And where can we find you if people are into eco-psychology, bird divination, all the beautiful things you offer?
So I have a website that offers online resources for bird divination. My website is wakeecohealing.com. And then that's also where registration is for my in-person workshops. You can find me on Instagram. I've been experimenting with posting bird divination practices for people to engage in individually. And also the Earth Wild Ecology Club that I co-founded with my good friend, Miranda Hansen. She's a fellow eco-psychologist. We offer virtual eco-psychological workshops together. She is based in California, so we're offering these coast-to-coast gatherings.
That's so beautiful. Yes. I'm so glad we're in this conversation together. And I think there's a part of my 18, 19 year old self who ran away from environmental science because I could not handle the ecological grief or ecological anxiety from climate change. Is so happy that there are people who are talking about eco-psychology and talking about act of hope and collectively of how we might make a difference.
Yeah, it can be really discouraging to just sit with the science of the downfall of Earth.
Yes.
And it feels really empowering and hopeful to sit on the opposite side of that.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to ADHD Gathering. If this episode spoke to you, share it with someone who needs to hear it. You never know whose landscape it might open up. And if you're ready to go deeper, come find me. Coaching Discovery link is in the show notes. Until next time, take good care of your ecosystem.